and if it is raining. The plausibility of the inductive conclusion in these cases contributes to making the invalid deductive conclusion plausible as well. The lists of argument forms and logical errors are very long, but these are some of the most common and important errors. Pragmatic reasoning schemas. The abstract version of the conditional, if P, then Q, is difficult to use. We do reason in accord with conditional logic all the time, but rarely by applying a completely abstract version of it. Instead, we're more likely to use what I call pragmatic reasoning schemas, that is, sets of rules useful for thinking about everyday life situations. This book is full of such schemas. In fact, at some level, that's what the book is all about. Some of the schemas map directly onto conditional logic. These include, for example, the schema distinguishing between independent and dependent events and the principle that correlation doesn't prove causation. The sunk cost principle and the opportunity cost principle are deductively valid and can be derived logically from the principles of cost-benefit analysis. Economics courses teach these principles, though not as well as they could because they're typically not very good at showing how the formal principles can be used pragmatically for everyday reasoning. Some pragmatic reasoning schemas map onto conditional logic but fall short of being deductively valid because they don't guarantee a correct answer. In fact, they're not concerned with truth or validity at all, but with assessing whether a person's conduct is proper. This branch of logic is called deontic, from the Greek deon meaning duty. It deals with what kind of situation constitutes an obligation, what kind gives permission, what's optional behavior, what's beyond the call of duty, and what ought to be done. Contractual schemas are one type of deontic schema that can be used to solve a wide range of problems related to permission and obligation. The deontic schema that's necessary for getting the drinking age problem right is called the permission schema. You want to drink, P, better be 21, Q. Not 21, not Q, better not be drinking, not P. A kindred schema is the obligation schema. If you're 18, P, you must register for the draft, Q. Didn't register for the draft, not Q, then you better not be 18, or you didn't meet your obligation. 2 years of law school improves deontic reasoning quite a bit, but 2 years of graduate training in philosophy, psychology, chemistry, or medicine does nothing for this kind of reasoning. A second type of pragmatic reasoning schema doesn't map onto conditional logic at all, or at least it isn't very profitable to try such a mapping, but applies to an enormous range of situations and can be described in purely abstract terms. Logical thinking is required for using these schemas, but the logic isn't what makes them powerful. Rather, it's their ability to shed light on everyday problems. These include statistical schemas and schemas for scientific procedures, such as the randomized control design. Statistics and methodology courses teach these concepts, but don't always succeed very well in creating pragmatic schemas that are helpful in everyday life. Both undergraduate and graduate courses in social sciences and psychology, but not natural sciences or the humanities, do enhance pragmatic schemas that help in applying statistical and methodological schemas to everyday problems. Other highly general pragmatic reasoning schemas include Occam's razor, the tragedy of the commons, and the concept of emergence, discussed in Chapter 15. Finally, some powerful pragmatic reasoning schemas don't constitute abstract blueprints for reasoning, but are merely empirical principles that facilitate correct solutions to a broad range of everyday problems. These include the fundamental attribution error, the generalization that actors and observers tend to explain behavior differently, loss aversion, the status quo bias, the principle that some choice architectures are generally superior to others in the quality of choices they encourage, and the principle that incentives aren't necessarily the best way to get people to change their behavior, among dozens of others in this book. Abstract pragmatic schemas are tremendously useful, but purely logical schemas are of limited value. I believe this is the case because there's a very high civilization, namely Confucian Chinese, that never developed purely logical formalisms. It's that civilization's dialectic tradition and modern additions to it that are covered in the next chapter. Summing up, logic divests arguments of any references to the real world so that the formal structure of an argument can be laid bare without any interference from prior beliefs. Formal logic, contrary to the opinions of educators for 2,600 years, doesn't constitute the basis of everyday thought. It's primarily a way of thinking that can catch some kinds of errors in reasoning. The truth of a conclusion and the validity of a conclusion are entirely separate things. The conclusion of an argument is valid only if it follows logically from its premises, though it may be true regardless of the truth of the premises or whether it follows logically from the premises. An inference need not be logically derivable from any other premises, but it gains and claims for credence if it can be shown to have logical as well as empirical support. Venn diagrams embody syllogistic reasoning and can be helpful or even necessary for solving some categorization problems. Errors in deductive reasoning are sometimes made because they map onto argument forms that are inductively valid. That's part of the reason we're susceptible to making deduction errors. Pragmatic reasoning schemas are abstract rules of reasoning that underlie much of thought. These include deontic rules such as the permission schema and the obligation schema. They also include many inductive schemas discussed in this book, such as those for statistics, cost-benefit analysis, and reasoning in accord with sound methodological procedures. Pragmatic reasoning schemas are not as general as the rules of logic because they apply only in specific situations, but some of them rest on logical foundations. Others, such as Occam's razor and the concept of emergence, are widely applicable but don't rest on formal logic. Still others are merely empirical generalizations of great practical utility, such as the fundamental attribution error. Chapter 14. Dialectical Reasoning. The most striking difference between the traditions at the two ends of the civilized world is in the destiny of logic. For the West, logic has been central, and the thread of transmission has never snapped. Angus Graham, philosopher. It is precisely because the Chinese mind is so rational that it refuses to become rationalistic and separate form from content. Xu Shen Lu, philosopher. To argue with logical consistency may not only be resented, but also be regarded as immature. Nobuhiro Nagashima, anthropologist. If you're a person who grew up in a Western culture, you may be surprised by the fact that one of the world's great civilizations, namely China, has no history of formal logic. From before the time of Plato until very recent times, when the Chinese encountered Western thought, there was virtually no concern at all with logic in the East. At the moment when Aristotle was developing formal logic, the Chinese philosopher Mozu and his followers did deal with some issues touching on logic, but neither he nor anyone else in the tradition of classical Chinese culture ever developed a formalized system. And after a brief flurry of interest in Mozu's thought, the trail of logic went cold in the East. Mozu, incidentally, did systematic work on cost-benefit analysis, centuries before anyone in the West dealt seriously with the topic. So how did the Chinese manage to make great progress in mathematics, as well as invent hundreds of important things that the West invented much later or not at all, if they lacked a tradition of logic? We're forced to acknowledge that a civilization can make enormous strides without ever paying much attention to formal logic. This is true not only of China, but of all cultures in East Asia with roots in the Confucian tradition, including Japan and Korea. It's not true of India, where there is a concern with logic extending back to roughly the 5th or 4th century BC. Interestingly, the Chinese were aware of Indian work on logic and translated some logic texts by Indians. But the Chinese translations are full of errors, and the influence of these texts was minimal. The system of thought that the Chinese developed instead of logic has been called dialectical reasoning. Dialectical reasoning is actually opposed to formal logic in many ways. Western logic versus Eastern dialecticism. Aristotle placed at the foundation of logical thought the following three propositions. 1. Identity. A equals A. Whatever is A is itself and not some other thing. 2. Non-contradiction. A and not A can't both be the case. Nothing can both be and not be. A proposition and its opposite can't both be true. 3. Excluded middle. Everything must either be or not be. A or not A can be true, but not something in between. Modern Westerners accept these propositions, but people who grew up in the intellectual tradition of China don't buy into them, at least not for every kind of problem. Instead, it is dialecticism that is at the foundation of Eastern thought. As the psychologist Kai-Ping Peng has described, three principles underlie Eastern dialecticism. Notice I didn't say propositions. Peng warns that the term proposition has much too formal a ring for what is a generalized stance toward the world rather than a set of ironclad rules. 1. Principle of change. Reality is a process of change. What is currently true will shortly be false. 2. Principle of contradiction. Contradiction is the dynamic underlying change. Because change is constant, contradiction is constant. 3. Principle of relationships, or holism. The whole is more than the sum of its parts. Parts are meaningful only in relation to the whole. These principles are intimately linked. Change creates contradiction, and contradiction produces change. Constant change and contradiction imply that it's meaningless to discuss the individual part without considering its relationships with other parts and with prior states of the world. The principles also imply another important tenet of Eastern thought, which is the insistence on finding the middle way between extreme propositions. There is a strong presumption that contradictions often are merely apparent, and an inclination to believe that A is right but not A is not wrong. This stance is captured by the Zen Buddhist dictum that the opposite of a great truth is also true. To many Westerners, these notions may seem reasonable and even familiar. The Socratic dialogue, often called dialectical, is similar in some ways. This is a conversation exchanging different viewpoints with the goal of more closely approaching the truth. Jews borrowed that version of dialectical thinking from the Greeks, and Talmudic scholars developed it over the next 2 millennia and more. Western philosophers of the 18th and 19th centuries, such as Hegel and Marx, made contributions to the dialectical tradition. Dialectical reasoning became a topic of serious study by cognitive psychologists in both the East and the West, beginning in the late 20th century. The Eastern dialectical stance reflects the deep infusion of Eastern thought by the Tao. The Tao means a thousand things to an Easterner, but at base it captures the concept of change. Yin, the feminine and dark and passive, alternates with Yang, the masculine and light and active. Indeed, Yin and Yang only exist because of each other, and when the world is in a Yin state, this is a sure sign that it's about to be in a Yang state. The sign of the Tao, which means the way to exist with nature and with one's fellow humans, consists of two forces in the form of a white and a black swirl. The concept of change is represented by the fact that the black swirl contains a white dot, and the white swirl contains a black dot. And the truest yang is the yang that is in the yin. The yin-yang principle expresses the relationship that exists between opposing but interpenetrating forces that may complete each other, make each other comprehensible, or create the conditions for one to alter into the other. From the I Ching, Book of Changes. For misery, happiness is leaning against it. For happiness, misery is hiding in it. Who knows whether it is misery or happiness? There is no certainty. The righteous suddenly becomes the vicious. The good suddenly becomes the bad. A familiarity with Eastern dialecticism makes it easier to understand the very different assumptions about change, characteristic of Eastern and Western thought. Li Junli has shown that for trends of any kind at all, world tuberculosis rate, growth in GDP of developing countries, rates of diagnosis of autism in American children, Westerners tend to assume the trend will continue in its current direction. Easterners are much more likely to assume that a given trend may level off or actually reverse itself. Business school students steeped in the Western tradition are inclined to buy a stock that's going up and dump a stock that's going down. Students raised in the Eastern tradition are inclined to buy a stock that's going down and sell one that's going up. Recall from part two that this is a clear instance of an erroneous preference. The dialectical tradition explains in part why East Asians are more attentive to context, discussed in chapter two. If things are constantly changing, you better pay attention to the circumstances surrounding a given event. Things are going on to influence the event that will result in change and contradiction. The logical tradition and the dialectical tradition produce quite different reactions to contradictory propositions and arguments. If you present people with two propositions implying the opposite of each other, which are close to being a direct contradiction, Westerners and Easterners respond in very different ways. Students at the University of Michigan and at Beijing University were presented with pairs of alleged scientific findings. For example, some students read, 1. Fuel usage in a large number of developing countries indicates a great worsening of environmental problems, including global warming. And 2. A meteorologist studied temperatures in 24 widely separated parts of the world and found that temperatures had actually dropped by a fraction of a degree each of the last 5 years. Other students read just one of these propositions. All students were asked how plausible they found the propositions to be. Michigan students were more inclined to believe the more plausible proposition, such as 1, above, when they saw it contradicted by a less plausible proposition, such as 2, above, than when they merely saw the more plausible proposition by itself. This pattern is not logically coherent. A proposition can't be more believable when it's contradicted by something than when it's not contradicted. The error probably occurs because of Western eagerness to resolve a contradiction by deciding which proposition is correct. The process of choosing involves focusing on all the reasons the more plausible proposition is to be preferred. Confirmation bias at work. Thus beefed up, the more plausible proposition seems stronger than it would if the person hadn't gone through the process of choosing between it and a seemingly contradictory, less plausible proposition. Chinese students' behavior couldn't be more different. They placed more credence in the less plausible proposition when they saw it contradicted than when they didn't see it contradicted. This is also logically incoherent, but follows from the sense that there must be some truth to each of two contradictory statements. Once the less probable proposition has been bolstered by finding ways in which it might be true, it seems more plausible than if that bolstering process hadn't occurred. One might almost say that Easterners sometimes display an anti-confirmation bias. So Western thought can get things wrong in its rush to stamp out a seeming contradiction rather than entertaining the possibility that both propositions might have some truth. Eastern thought can get things wrong by finding weak propositions more plausible when contradicted because of an attempt to bolster a weak proposition in order to split the difference with a contradictory but stronger argument. The logical and dialectical systems of thought have a lot to learn from each other. Each gets some things right that the other gets wrong. Logic versus the Tao. The shaky hold on logic, characteristic of East Asians, is evident today in the thinking even of young people studying in the best Asian universities. Consider the following three arguments. Which seem to you to be logically valid? Argument 1. Premise 1. No police dogs are old. Premise 2. Some highly trained dogs are old. Conclusion. Some highly trained dogs are police dogs. Argument 2. Premise 1. All things that are made of plants are good for the health. Premise 2. Cigarettes are things that are made of plants. Conclusion. Cigarettes are good for the health. Argument 3. Premise 1. No A are B. Premise 2. Some C are B. Conclusion. Some C are not A. The first argument is meaningful and has a plausible conclusion. The second argument is meaningful, but its conclusion is not plausible. And the third argument is so abstract that it makes no contact at all with any real-world facts. Despite the plausibility of its conclusion, argument 1 is invalid. Despite the implausibility of argument 2, it is valid. and the meaningless argument 3, as it happens, is invalid. Try drawing Venn diagrams of these arguments to see how helpful they can be in assessing validity. The psychologists Era Norenzayan, Byom Jun Kim, and their co-workers attempted to find out whether Asians and Westerners thought about problems like these differently. They presented Korean and American university students with arguments that were either valid or invalid, and that had conclusions that were either plausible or implausible. The researchers asked them to evaluate whether the conclusion followed logically from the premises for each argument. There were a total of 4 different types of syllogisms, ranging from very simple structures to quite complicated ones. Both Koreans and Americans were more likely to rate syllogisms with plausible conclusions as being valid, whether they were or not. But Koreans were much more influenced by the plausibility of the conclusion than were Americans. This didn't happen because the Korean participants were less capable of performing logical operations than the American participants. The two groups made an equal number of errors on the purely abstract syllogisms. It's just that Americans are more in the habit of applying logical rules to ordinary events than are Koreans, and are therefore more capable of ignoring the plausibility of the conclusion. East Asian university students also make mistakes in syllogisms based on how typical the member of a category is. The investigators told the students, for example, that all birds have a given property, a made-up one, such as have an omentum. They next asked the students either how convincing it is that eagles have the property, or how convincing it is that penguins have the property. The two conclusions are, of course, equally valid. Americans were much less affected by typicality than were Koreans. For example, Koreans were not as convinced as Americans were that penguins have the property, given that birds have the property. Finally, East Asian students have more problems with propositional logic than do Americans. They're more thrown off by their desires. If they would like a particular conclusion to be true, they're more likely to judge incorrectly that the conclusion follows from the premises. This is not the sort of error one wants to make. It indicates that facility with logic, being able to strip meaning away from propositions and convert them into abstractions, helps Westerners avoid undue influences on judgments. Context, contradiction, and causality. Recall from Chapter 2, in the discussion about the importance of context, that the Western approach to thinking about the world is to focus on a central object or person. Westerners identify the attributes of an object, assign the object to a category, and apply the rules that govern that category of objects. The underlying purpose is often to establish a causal model of the object so that it can be manipulated for one's own goals. The Eastern approach is to attend much more broadly to the object in its context, to the relationships among objects, and to the relationship between object and context. Different approaches to historical analysis follow from these differences in how best to understand the world. Japanese teachers of history begin by setting out the context of events in some detail. They then proceed through the important events in chronological order, linking each event to its successor. Teachers encourage their students to imagine the mental and emotional states of historical figures by thinking about the analogy between their situations and the situations of the students' everyday lives. The actions are then explained in terms of these feelings. Teachers regard students as having good ability to think historically when they show empathy with the historical figures, including those who were Japan's enemies. How questions are asked frequently, about twice as often as in American classrooms. American teachers spend less time setting the context than Japanese teachers do. They begin with the outcome, rather than with the initial event or catalyst. The chronological order of events is slighted or even destroyed in presentation. Instead, the order in which factors are considered is dictated by discussion of the causal factors assumed to be important. The Ottoman Empire collapsed for 3 major reasons. Teachers regard students as having good ability to reason historically when they are capable of providing evidence to fit their causal model of the outcome. Why questions are asked twice as frequently in American classrooms as in Japanese classrooms. Both approaches seem useful and complementary, but in fact, East Asian historical analysis seems simply wrong to Westerners. and in general, rather than appreciating the holistic style of thought characteristic of the East, Westerners frequently reject the approach. Remarkably, the children of Japanese businessmen living in the United States are sometimes put back a grade in their American school because their teachers find them to be lacking in analytic ability. The different types of thought result in very different metaphysics or assumptions about the nature of the world. The differences in patterns of thought also produce different physics. Because of their attention to context, the ancient Chinese got some things right that the Greeks got wrong. Ancient Chinese attention to context encouraged the realization that there could be action at a distance. This allowed the Chinese to correctly understand questions of acoustics and magnetism, as well as to comprehend the true reason for the tides. That the moon could drag the oceans along eluded even Galileo. Aristotle's explanation of why objects fall when dropped into water is that they possess the property of gravity. But not all objects fall when dropped into water. Some stay on the surface. These objects, Aristotle explained, possess the property of levity. But of course, there is no such property as levity, and gravity is a relation between objects rather than a property of a single object. Einstein had to add a cheater factor to his theories about the nature of the universe, namely the cosmological constant, in order to account for what he was confident was the steady state of the universe. But of course, the universe isn't in a steady state, as had been assumed since the time of Aristotle. As a Westerner, thoroughly imbued with Greek assumptions about stasis, Einstein had a gut instinct that the universe should be constant, so he resorted to the cosmological constant to preserve the assumption. Chinese dialectical reasoning had an impact on the physicist Niels Bohr, who was highly knowledgeable about Eastern thought. He attributed his development of quantum theory in part to the metaphysics of the East. There had been a centuries-long debate in the West about whether light consists of particles or waves. Belief in one was assumed to contradict and render impossible belief in the other. Bohr's solution was to say that light can be thought of in both ways. In quantum theory, light can be viewed either as a particle or as a wave, just never both at the same time. But while the Chinese got a lot of things right that the West got wrong, they could never have proved their theories correct. For that, it takes science, which the West has had for 2,600 years. Science, at base, is categorization plus empirical rules and a commitment to logical principles. The Chinese understood the concept of action at a distance when Westerners didn't, but it was Western science that proved the concept to be correct. This was done by scientists who set out to conduct experiments intended to show that action at a distance was impossible. They were startled by findings showing it was indeed possible. Stability and change. There is a profound difference between Eastern and Western beliefs about change. For reasons that aren't at all clear to me, the Greeks were positively obsessed with the idea that the universe and the objects in it don't change. It's true that Heraclitus and other 6th century BC philosophers recognized that the world changes. A man never steps in the same river twice because the man is different and the river is different. But by the 5th century BC, change was out and stability was in. Heraclitus's views were actually ridiculed. Parmenides proved, in a few easy steps, that change was impossible. To say of a thing that it doesn't exist is a contradiction. Non-being is self-contradictory, and so non-being can't exist. If non-being can't exist, then nothing can change, because if thing one were to change to thing two, then thing one would not be. Zeno, Parmenides' pupil, proved to many Greek satisfaction that motion is impossible. One proof is his famous treatment of the arrow. 1. When an arrow is in a place just its own size, it's at rest. 2. At every moment of its flight, the arrow is in a place just its own size. 3. Therefore, at every moment of its flight, the arrow is at rest. 4. Since the arrow is always at rest, we see that motion, hence change, is impossible. Another of Zeno's proofs is the Achilles paradox. If Achilles is trying to catch a slower runner ahead of him, a tortoise, say, he must run to the place where the tortoise is at the moment. But by the time Achilles gets there, the tortoise has moved on. Ergo, Achilles can never catch the tortoise. Since fast runners can never catch slow ones, we can deduce that motion never occurs. As the communications theorist Robert Logan has written, the Greeks were enslaved to the rigid linearity of their either-or logic. The Greek insistence on an unchanging or highly stable world echoes down through the centuries. The extreme Western insistence on attributing human behavior to a person's enduring dispositions rather than to situational factors, the fundamental attribution error, is directly traceable to Greek metaphysics. One of the clearest examples of the damage done by the fundamental attribution error has to do with Western misunderstanding of some important influences on intelligence and academic achievement. I began to have trouble with math in the fifth grade. My parents assured me that was to be expected. Nisbets had never been much good at math. I was delighted to have the alibi. But in retrospect, I can see that my parents and I neglected to see that my problems with math began after a 2-week bout of mononucleosis sidelined me from school. As it happened, that was the period when my class had taken up fractions. I'm still not much good at math, though I do believe I would have been better at it if I hadn't accepted my parents' dispositional inference about my ability to deal with fractions. Contrast my parents' attribution with what might be expected from a Chinese-American tiger mother. You come home with B's in math on your report card, you start getting A's if you want to be a member of this family. For the 2,000 years since it became possible for a Chinese peasant boy to become the most powerful magistrate in the land through study, the Chinese have believed that hard work makes you smart. Confucius believed that part of ability was a gift from heaven, but most of it was due to effort. A study of American high school seniors begun in 1968 found that the Chinese heritage students among them were about even in IQ with their Caucasian counterparts. But the students of Chinese heritage scored about a third of a standard deviation better on the SAT. SAT scores are highly correlated with IQ, but SAT scores owe more to study than IQ scores do. Astonishingly, a couple of decades after high school graduation, the Chinese Americans were 62% more likely to work in professional, managerial, or technical fields than the European Americans. Even among European Americans, students who view ability as modifiable do much better in school than those who don't. And when European Americans are taught that how smart you are is in good part due to how hard you work, it improves their school performance. Learning about the importance of effort is particularly powerful for poor Black and Hispanic children. East-West differences in beliefs about malleability and change reverberate through an enormous number of domains of life. People of European culture, especially Americans, label a person convicted of theft or homicide as a criminal. Asians avoid such firm categorizations. Perhaps as a consequence, lengthy incarcerations are relatively rare in Asia. The U.S. incarceration rate is 5 times that of Hong Kong, 8 times that of South Korea, and 14 times that of Japan. Dialecticism and wisdom. The following letter was sent to the advice columnist Abigail Van Buren and published in scores of newspapers. Please think for a moment about the likely outcome of a situation like the one described there. Dear Abby, my husband Ralph has one sister, Dawn, and one brother, Kurt. Their parents died 6 years ago, within months of each other. Ever since, Dawn has once a year mentioned buying a headstone for their parents. I'm all for it, but Dawn is determined to spend a bundle on it, and she expects her brothers to help foot the bill. She recently told me she had put $2,000 aside to pay for it. Recently, Dawn called to announce that she had gone ahead, selected the design, written the epitaph, and ordered the headstone. Now she expects Kurt and Ralph to pay their share back to her. She said she went ahead and ordered it on her own because she has been feeling guilty all these years that her parents didn't have one. I feel that since Dawn did this all by herself, her brothers shouldn't have to pay her anything. I know that if Kurt and Ralph don't pay her back, they'll never hear the end of it, and neither will I. What should I do about this? After a little more explication of East-West differences in thinking patterns, we'll return to this vignette. Recall that Jean Piaget, the great mid-20th century developmental psychologist, held that the basis of all thought after childhood was propositional logic. He referred to these logical rules as formal operations, as distinct from the concrete operations that characterize how children think about specific real events, such as the conservation of matter across the shape of its container. There's neither more nor less sand when you pour it from a tall, narrow container into a short, wide one. Piaget held that young children use logic to develop their understanding of events in the world, but they lack the ability to use logic to think abstractly. As children enter adolescence, they shift toward using formal operations to think about abstract concepts. Formal operations, the rules of propositional logic, can only be induced and can't be taught. They are fully developed by the end of adolescence. There is no more learning about how to think using abstract rules after that point. Every normal adult has the exact same set of rules for formal logic. Most of that story is mistaken. As this book shows, there are innumerable abstract rules beyond those of formal operations, such as the concepts of statistical regression and cost-benefit analysis. Moreover, these abstract rules can be both induced and taught, and we keep on learning them well after adolescence. Partly as a reaction to Piaget's theories, psychologists in the late 20th century began to define what they called post-formal operations, that is to say, principles of thought that are learned primarily after adolescence and typically don't guarantee a single correct answer, but rather a range of plausible answers. Instead, application of the principles may result merely in new perspectives on problems or provide pragmatic guidance for dealing with apparent logical contradictions and social conflict. The post-formalists, notably Klaus Ruegel and Michael Basichus, labeled this type of thinking dialectical. They relied heavily on Eastern thought in describing and elucidating these principles, which can be grouped under five rubrics. Relations and context. Dialectical thinking emphasizes attention to relations and contexts, the importance of locating an object or phenomenon as part of some larger whole. An emphasis on understanding how systems function, a concern with equilibrium in systems, such as the body, groups, factory operations, and the need to view problems from many perspectives. Anti-formalism. Dialectical thinking opposes formalism because of its separation of form from content. We make errors by abstracting the elements of a problem into a formal model and ignoring facts and contexts crucial to correct analysis. Overemphasis on logical approaches leads to distortion, error, and rigidity. Contradiction. The post-formalists emphasize the importance of identifying contradictions between propositions and between systems, and of recognizing that opposites can complement each other and lead to greater understanding than an insistence on the rejection of one idea in favor of another. Change. Post-formalist psychologists emphasize the importance of understanding events as moments in a process rather than static, one-off occurrences. They recognize interaction between systems as a source of change. Uncertainty. Partly because of their emphasis on change, their acknowledgement of contradiction, and their recognition of the multiple influences present in most contexts, post-formalists place a value on recognizing the uncertainty of knowledge. These principles of thought are not alien to Westerners. The difference between Easterners and Westerners is that Easterners regard them as fundamental and use them all constantly. Let's look at some examples of the use of these principles for everyday problems. Culture, aging, and dialecticism. The psychologists Igor Grossman, Jing-Kyung Na, Denise Park, Michael Varnum, Shinobu Kitayama, and I gave problems such as the Dear Abby dilemma described a few minutes ago, as well as problems concerning societal conflicts such as ethnic discord and disagreements about use of natural resources, to people of a wide variety of ages and social classes in both the United States and Japan. We asked participants what they thought would happen next and why, and coded answers in terms of six categories related to dialectical reasoning. 1. Does the answer avoid rigid application of a rule? 2. Does the answer take into account the perspectives of each protagonist? 3. Is the answer attentive to the nature of the contradictory views? 4. Does the answer recognize the possibility of change rather than a stalemate? 5. Does the answer mention possible forms of compromise? 6. Does the answer express uncertainty rather than dogmatic confidence? We found that young and middle-aged Japanese responded to interpersonal and societal conflicts in a more dialectical fashion than did young and middle-aged Americans. The Japanese were more likely to avoid rigid application of a rule, more likely to take into account the perspectives of all participants, more attentive to the nature of the conflict, and more likely to recognize the possibility of change and compromise. They expressed less certainty about their conclusions. You're about to hear examples of answers reflecting more and less dialectical approaches to the Dear Abby column, describing a conflict among siblings over a payment for a headstone for their mother. All the answers are those of American subjects, but Japanese answers were completely comparable. It's just that they were more likely to provide dialectical answers. Examples of responses for the headstone story, showing more and less dialectical reasoning. Considering the different perspectives of people involved in the conflict. Less dialectical. I can imagine that it was a sour relationship afterward because, let's just say that Kurt and Ralph decided not to go ahead and pay for the headstone. Then it's going to create a gap of communication between her sister and her brothers. If the gravestone was just as important to them, then it wouldn't have been a problem about them getting the money in the beginning. More dialectical. Somebody might believe that we need to honor parents like this. Another person might think there isn't anything that needs to be done. Or another person might not have the financial means to do anything. Or it could also mean that it might not be important to the brothers. It often happens that people have different perspectives on situations important to them. Recognizing multiple ways the conflict might unfold. Less dialectical. She probably ended up having to pay for it herself, and she probably bugs them about it. Because if they wanted to help, they would have already given her money, I think. I don't think there really is an outcome. More dialectical. It could have several outcomes. The brothers might have reimbursed the sister, and then there was resentment on the wife's part. Or there could have been resentment for all three. Or the brothers could have refused to pay, and she may have accepted it. Or maybe one brother would have paid. Search for a compromise. Less dialectical. They probably didn't have the money. Otherwise, they would have done it sooner. And Dawn's going to be stuck with a bill, period. She should be stuck with a bill if she went ahead without their okay. I think she footed the bill herself, and so she was bitter toward her brothers after that, which she shouldn't be. She took it upon herself. More dialectical. I would think there would probably be some compromise reached, that Kurt and Ralph realized that it's important to have some kind of headstone. Although Dawn ordered it without them agreeing, they would probably pitch in somehow, even if it was not what she wanted ideally. But hopefully there was some kind of contribution. In our view, the generally more dialectical answers of the Japanese were a reflection of greater wisdom on their part. And we're in good company. We presented the problems along with Japanese and American answers to members of the University of Chicago-based Wisdom Network. The network consists of, heavily Western, philosophers, social psychologists, psychotherapists, and members of the clergy interested in the nature of wisdom and how people can attain it. Members of the network endorsed the more dialectical answers to the Dear Abby-type problems as being wiser. As people get older, do they get wiser in the sense that they become more likely to apply dialectical reasoning to social conflict? Americans do. From the age of about 25 to about 75, Americans get steadily more likely to apply dialectical approaches to interpersonal and societal problems. It stands to reason that people would become wiser about how to handle social conflict as they get older. They could be expected to become more likely to recognize the potential for it, learn ways of avoiding it, and develop ways of reducing it if it occurs. But Japanese don't get wiser in these respects. Here's how we account for the fact that Americans become more dialectical with age and Japanese don't. Younger Japanese are wiser about conflict than younger Americans because their socialization emphasizes attention to social context. They are explicitly taught how to avoid and reduce conflict, which is much more damaging to the social fabric in the East than in the West. Young Americans are less likely to be taught dialectical principles or how to deal with conflict. But as Americans experience more and more conflict over their lifespan, they induce ever better ways of recognizing and dealing with it. Japanese don't get better with age because they're merely applying early learned concepts rather than increasing their repertoire of conflict-related principles in the conduct of everyday life. Moreover, they encounter much less conflict in their daily lives than Americans, and so they don't have occasion to induce ever better ways of dealing with it. So is logical thinking or dialectical thinking better in general? This may sound like a nonsensical question. I've argued that both have their advantages and disadvantages. Sometimes it's helpful to abstract an argument to the point that its logical structure can be examined, but sometimes it's a mistake to insist on separating form from content. Sometimes it's helpful to try to dissolve contradictions, but sometimes it's more productive to acknowledge them and see whether the truth might lie between the contradictory ideas, or whether it's possible to transcend the contradictions and find some respect in which both are true. But I'll stick my neck out and hazard the generalization that logical thinking is crucial for scientific thought and some kinds of well-defined problems. Dialectical thinking is often more helpful for thinking about everyday problems, especially those involving human relations. Assuming that you agree with East Asians, the elderly, and the members of the Chicago Wisdom Network about the value of dialectical thinking, could you learn to be more dialectical in your own life? I think so, and I think you have already. Much of what you've heard in this book is sympathetic to dialectical reasoning and skeptical about too much reliance on formal analytic procedures. The book has emphasized the importance of paying attention to context, thereby combating the fundamental attribution error, the likelihood of variability and change in processes and in individuals, weakening susceptibility to the interview illusion, the fact that the attributes of objects and people tend to be associated with other attributes, encouraging attention to problems of self-selection, and the uncertainty of knowledge, strengthening concern with true score, measurement error, accuracy of assessment of correlations, reliability, and validity. And most important of all, ATTBW. Assumptions tend to be wrong. Summing up. Some of the fundamental principles underlying Western and Eastern thought are different. Western thought is analytic and emphasizes logical concepts of identity and insistence on non-contradiction. Eastern thought is holistic and encourages recognition of change and acceptance of contradiction. Western thought encourages separation of form from content in order to assess validity of arguments. A consequence is that Westerners are spared some logical errors that Easterners make. Eastern thought produces more accurate beliefs about some aspects of the world and the causes of human behavior than Western thought. Eastern thought prompts attention to the contextual factors influencing the behavior of objects and humans. It also prompts recognition of the likelihood of change in all kinds of processes and in individuals. Westerners and Easterners respond in quite different ways to contradictions between two propositions. Westerners sometimes actually believe a strong proposition more when it is contradicted by a weak proposition than when encountering it by itself. Easterners may actually believe a weak proposition more when it is contradicted by a strong proposition than when encountering it by itself. Eastern and Western approaches to history are very different. Eastern approaches emphasize context, preserve the order of events, and emphasize the relations between them, and encourage empathy with historical figures. Western approaches tend to slight contextual factors, are less concerned about preservation of the sequence of events, and emphasize causal modeling of historical processes. Western thought has been influenced substantially by Eastern thought in recent decades. Traditional Western propositional logic has been supplemented by dialectical principles. The two traditions of thought provide good platforms for critiquing each other. The virtues of logical thought seem more obvious in light of dialectical failings, and the virtues of dialectical thought appear more obvious in light of the limitations of logical thought. Reasoning about social conflict by younger Japanese is wiser than that of younger Americans, but Americans gain in wisdom over their lifespan and Japanese do not. Japanese, and undoubtedly other East Asians, are taught about how to avoid and resolve social conflict. Americans are taught less about it and have more to gain as they grow older. Part 6. Knowing the World. Many years ago, I began having casual conversations about reasoning with two young philosophers, Stephen Stitch and Alvin Goldman. The conversation turned serious when we began to realize that we were interested in many of the same questions concerning epistemology. Epistemology is the study of what counts as knowledge, how we can best obtain knowledge, and what can be known with certainty. The three of us and a psychology graduate student named Tim Wilson started a long-running seminar. The philosophers were quite taken with the idea that there was a science purporting to address empirically some of the philosophical questions about knowledge that had been around for 2,600 years. They were intrigued to find that psychologists had begun to study reasoning tools of the kind reported in this book, such as schemas and heuristics, and to show the relevance of tools of scientific discovery to understanding of everyday life. Moreover, they saw that psychologists really did have ways of scientifically investigating some of these questions. They also saw that the philosophical literature had much to offer the scientific approach to reasoning, both with respect to guidance about the important questions to ask and what can be regarded as knowledge. Goldman gave the name epistemics to the new discipline that fuses theory of knowledge, cognitive psychology, and philosophy of science, which is concerned with appraisal of the methods and conclusions of scientists. Stitch began a movement called X-Phi. The X stands for experimental. The Greek symbol Phi stands for philosophy. Stitch and his many students have continued to do work that is both excellent psychology and important philosophy. I hasten to say that none of us was as original as we initially thought. It turned out that many philosophers and psychologists were thinking along similar lines. But I think we did help to crystallize some important ideas that were floating around in the zeitgeist. Chapters 15 and 16 deal in part with epistemics as defined by Goldman. The work discussed also reflects the experimental stance of X-Phi as developed by Stitch. The philosopher's stock in trade has always been assertions about our intuitions. Stitch and his colleagues have shown that intuitions about the nature of the world, what one can call knowledge, and what one regards as moral, can be so diverse across cultures and from individual to individual that it often makes no sense to appeal to a chimera called our intuitions. Chapter 15. Kiss and Tell. We consider it a good principle to explain the phenomena by the simplest hypothesis possible. Claudius Ptolemy. It is futile to do with more things that which can be done with fewer. William of Ockham. To the same natural effects, we must, so far as possible, assign the same causes. Isaac Newton. Whenever possible, substitute constructions out of known entities for inferences to unknown entities. Bertrand Russell. What counts as knowledge and what qualifies as an explanation are two of the main questions discussed in this book. They are also central concerns for philosophers of science. In the answers they give to these questions, philosophers of science perform both a function of describing what it is that scientists are doing and critiquing what they do. Conversely, some philosophers of science use the findings of scientists and experimental philosophers to address traditional philosophical questions, although this is a more controversial practice among philosophers than you might guess. Some of the important issues addressed by philosophers of science include: what constitutes a good theory? How economical or simple should a theory be? Can a scientific theory ever be confirmed, or is not yet falsified the best it can do? Can a theory be a good one if there is no way we could falsify it? What's wrong with special purpose ad hoc fixes to theory? All of these questions are as relevant to the theories and beliefs we hold about everyday life events as they are to the activities of scientists. KISS. In graduate school, I had a professor who was prone to generating highly complicated theories, much more complicated than I thought testable or likely to be supported by evidence in a convincing way. He defended himself by saying, "If the universe is pretzel-shaped, you better have pretzel-shaped hypotheses." My response, prudently uttered only to myself, was, "If you start out with pretzel-shaped hypotheses, the universe better be pretzel-shaped or you'll never find out what shape it is. Better to start with a straight line and go from there." The injunction against complexity has come to be labeled Occam's razor. Theories must be succinct. Unnecessary concepts have to be shaved away. In the scientific arena, the simplest theory capable of explaining the evidence wins. We abandon a simple theory only when there's a more complicated theory that explains more evidence than the simple theory. Simpler theories are also to be preferred because they tend to be easier to test, and in the more precise sciences, more readily modeled mathematically. Ptolemy didn't follow his own advice very well. The path of Mars around the Earth, as specified by Ptolemy, provided epicycle after epicycle in order to match the perceived motion of Mars. An epicycle is a circle on a circle. There was a strong prior assumption in Ptolemy's day that the universe was constructed on elegant geometric principles, employing especially the circle. If lots of circles were required to model planetary movement, so be it. Ptolemy's theory fit the data perfectly, but since no one could come up with laws of motion that were remotely plausible explanations for such a path, it seems puzzling that it took a very long time for people to realize that there was something drastically wrong with the theory. KISS, keep it simple, stupid, is a good motto for lots of things. Complicated theories and proposals and plans are likely to cause foul-ups. In my experience, people who sacrifice comprehensiveness and complexity for simplicity are more likely to come up with answers, to something at least, if not to the original question. Simple theories are to be preferred even when you know they're inadequate to explain all the available evidence. Testing more complicated theories is more labor-intensive and more likely to lead the investigator down a garden path. Early in my career, I studied the eating behavior of the obese. I found that their behavior resembled the behavior of rats with lesions to the ventromedial hypothalamus, VMH. Damage to that area of the brain made the rats act as if they were hungry all the time, and they ate enough to become obese. The analogy proved productive, and I was able to show that the feeding behavior of the obese is highly similar to that of rats with VMH lesions. This strongly suggested that obese people are hungry most of the time. I argued that they are attempting to defend a set point for weight that is higher for them than for most people. The best evidence for that comes from the fact that the eating behavior of obese people who are not trying to lose weight is the same as that of normal weight people, whereas the eating behavior of normal weight people who are trying to lose weight resembles that of obese people who are trying to lose weight. Experts in the field of eating behavior and obesity told me that the facts couldn't be fully explained by the simple hypothesis of defense of a set point for weight. True enough, but most of the people telling me that didn't really learn much about obesity, whereas people exploring simple hypotheses about obesity have learned a lot. What's sensible in science is also likely to be sensible in business and other professions. The KISS principle is explicit policy for some highly successful companies and is recommended by many business consultants. McKinsey & Company instructs its business consultants to keep hypotheses as simple as possible at first and to allow complications only as they are forced on them. People who offer advice to startup companies insist on keeping it simple at first. Release products quickly to get feedback rather than obsessively create the best possible product. Target markets where it's possible to maximize early profits rather than aim for a broad range of markets. Don't demand complete knowledge of markets or any other aspect of business before acting. Keep business models presented to potential investors as simple as possible. As they say at Google, done is better than perfect. Overly complicated ways of trying to solve a problem are sometimes called Rube Goldberg machines. Goldberg being the fellow who used to draw hilariously convoluted ways of solving a simple problem. For the all-time most spectacular Rube Goldberg machine, click on www.youtube.com/watch?v=QYB(Q-Y-B-F-N-Y-7-Y-8-W). The part of Occam's razor enjoining multiple hypotheses doesn't fully apply to practitioners, such as doctors. The more hypotheses, the better, when we're trying to decide which explanations are in contention and how they can best be examined. I don't want my doctor to entertain only the most plausible hypothesis. I want my doctor to pursue every hypothesis with some reasonable chance of being correct, as well as the possibility that two or more hypotheses are necessary to explain my symptoms. Even for medical diagnosis, though, some rules of parsimony apply. Medical schools teach their students to employ simple and inexpensive diagnostic procedures prior to more complicated and expensive ones, and to pursue the most likely possibilities first. Think horses, not zebras. Reductionism. An issue central to many philosophical and scientific debates concerns reductionism, a principle that at first blush resembles Occam's razor. A reductionist explanation is one holding that some seemingly complex phenomenon or system is nothing more than the sum of its parts. Reductionist explanations sometimes go further and maintain that the parts themselves are best understood at some level of complexity simpler than, or lower than, the phenomenon or system itself. That position denies the possibility of emergence, in which phenomena come into being that are not explicable solely by invoking processes at a simpler, more basic level. The example par excellence of emergence is consciousness. It has properties that don't exist at the level of the physical, chemical, and electrical events that underlie it, and so far at least are not explainable at that level. If you really can't get away with reductionism in either of the senses above, you justifiably win. But the people who study phenomena at a given level are naturally going to be opponents of people who try to dismiss events as mere epiphenomena, events secondary to the underlying events and lacking true causal significance. Some scientists believe that macroeconomics, the aggregate behavior and decision-making of the economy as a whole, is fully explained by microeconomics, choices that individuals make. Other scientists believe that microeconomics is fully explained by psychology. Still other scientists believe psychological phenomena can be fully explained by physiological processes, or undoubtedly will be at some future time, and so on. Physiological processes are fully explained by cellular biology, which is fully explained by molecular biology, which is fully explained by chemistry, which is fully explained by the quantum theory of the electromagnetic force, which is fully explained by particle physics. Of course, no one proposes that degree of reductionism. But at least some scientists have endorsed one or more of the individual reductions in that chain. Many reductionist efforts are useful. The principle of parsimony requires us to explain phenomena at the simplest level possible and to add complications only as they become necessary. And the effort to explain things at a level one down in the hierarchy can be useful, even if the ultimate conclusion is that there are indeed emergent properties that prevent a full explanation in terms of simpler underlying processes. But one person's simplification is another person's simple-mindedness. Scientists from other fields are continually trying to explain phenomena in my field of psychology by asserting that they are nothing but the operation of factors at some lower level of complexity. I'll describe two examples of reductionism for psychological events that seem to me to be misguided and off base. Full disclosure, recall that I'm a psychologist. A decade or so ago, a new editor of the prestigious Science magazine announced that under his regime, the magazine would not accept papers in psychology that failed to show pictures of the brain. This reflected his opinion that psychological phenomena could always be explained at the neural level, or at least that advances in our knowledge of psychological phenomena require at least partial understanding of the brain mechanisms underlying them. Few psychologists, or neuroscientists for that matter, would accept the idea that we're at a stage where purely psychological explanations of psychological phenomena should be considered useless or inadequate. The editor's insistence on physiological reductionism was at best premature. A much more consequential example of what the philosopher Daniel Dennett calls greedy reductionism is the policy formulated a decade or so ago by the head of the National Institute of Mental Health, NIMH, of refusing to support basic research in the behavioral sciences. The NIMH continues to support basic research in neuroscience and genetics, reflecting the director's highly controversial view that mental illness originates in physiological processes and can be understood primarily or even solely in terms of such processes, rather than as part of a loop among environmental events, mental representations, and biological processes. Despite the $25 billion that has been spent annually on basic neuroscience research by the National Institutes of Health and the $10 billion spent on basic genetic research, neither type of research has produced new treatments for mental illness. There have been no major advances in the treatment of schizophrenia for 50 years, or in the treatment of depression in 20 years. In contrast, there are many examples of effective treatments for mental illness resulting from basic research in behavioral science, and many more interventions that improve mental health and life satisfaction for normal individuals who would not be considered mentally ill. We can start with the fact that the theory behind Alcoholics Anonymous, according to its co-founder, came from adopting William James's theories of the role of religion in banishing despair and helplessness. The best diagnostic procedure available for assessing the likelihood that a person hospitalized for a suicide attempt will make another attempt is called the implicit association test. This measure was originally devised by social psychologists to assess a person's tacit, unrecognized attitudes toward various objects, events, and categories of people. A person whose tacit associations regarding the self are closer to concepts related to death than to life is likely to make a second attempt. Neither the person's self-report, physician's judgment, or any psychiatric test does as good a job at predicting a second attempt. The most effective treatment for phobias derives from basic research on animal and human learning. The best available intervention for psychological trauma, discussed in Chapter 10, derives from basic research in social psychology. And many other examples could be cited. Finally, behavioral science has been critical in establishing the ineffectiveness or actual damaging effects of mental health interventions invented by non-behavioral scientists. Know your own strength. We don't recognize how easy it is to generate hypotheses about the world. If we did, we'd generate fewer of them, or at least hold them more tentatively. We sprout causal theories in abundance when we learn of a correlation, and we readily find causal explanations for the failure of the world to confirm our hypotheses. We don't realize how easy it is for us to explain away evidence that would seem on the surface to contradict our hypotheses, and we fail to generate tests of a hypothesis that could falsify the hypothesis if, in fact, the hypothesis is wrong. This is one type of confirmation bias. Scientists make all of these mistakes. They sometimes generate hypotheses too readily. They may fail to recognize how easy it is to explain away contrary evidence, and they may not search for procedures that could falsify their hypotheses. Some of the more interesting and important controversies in science involve accusations of unconstrained theorizing, overly facile explanations for apparently contradictory evidence, and failure to recognize opportunities to falsify hypotheses. An American psychologist once wrote to Freud, describing experiments he believed supported Freud's theory of repression. Freud wrote back to him saying that he would have ignored the experiments if they had found evidence contradicting his theory. Therefore, he was obliged to ignore any experimental evidence allegedly supporting it. To his psychoanalytic colleagues, he sniffed, "Ganz Amerikanisch," completely American. Freud's put-down seems odd, inasmuch as Freud was a committed and highly successful experimenter himself when researching questions of neurology and hypnosis. But Freud's philosophy of science regarding psychoanalysis was that his interpretation of what his patients told him was the royal road to truth. Anyone who disagreed with these interpretations was simply making a grievous error.